What are the merits of meditation? What are the effective ways of integrating meditation practice in the everyday life of the students?
Well, I prefer to use the term bhavana or cultivation. It's a spiritual cultivation, which includes cultivation of our actions, our speech, and our mind. But because the things that we do and the things that we say spring from our mind and our intentions, then we take the training of the mind to be the essence of this cultivation. But when we talk about meditation practice and everyday life and integrating one into the other, then that can easily give the impression that there are two different things going on here. Whereas I would prefer to say that there is a certain kind of cultivation or bhavana which may be practiced sitting cross-legged with your eyes closed or walking up and down on a meditation path. And there are certain kinds of cultivation which can be practiced in what we call daily life. And there should be a seamless transition from one to the other, at least theoretically. So the value of the application of particular meditation techniques, what we often refer to as formal meditation, is, I think, the subject of this question. The practice of meditation, as is commonly understood, means that we retreat from, we take a step back from our responsibilities, our general conduct and interests, and focus directly on the body and the mind. And so whereas we're always trying to be present and to be aware of what's going on in daily life, it helps, at least for a certain period every day, to radically reduce the amount of sense contact and to be alone and with oneself, unmediated by other interests and activities. So that gives you an opportunity to see the nature of the body and mind, and to apply techniques of calming the mind and of dealing with negative mental states and developing positive mental states in a very direct kind of way. In daily life, of course, where there's so much going on and you don't have that kind of uninterrupted focus, and there are things pulling you here and pulling you there, it's a much more superficial kind of practice. The goal or the ideal here is that we are able to develop a power and like a foundation of awareness and calm from the formal meditation practice, which we can then draw upon in our daily life. But this is not a one-way process, because just as our ability to be aware and awake in daily activities is conditioned by the amount of time, effort we're willing to put into the formal meditation practice, similarly our success in the formal meditation practice is going to depend a lot on the quality of awareness when we're not meditating. So one affects the other. This is why I would recommend anyone who is developing their meditation techniques to meditate in the morning time, because if you meditate in the evenings, it's certainly beneficial, but it's that much more difficult to see the results in your daily life. Whereas if you meditate first thing in the morning, and then you feel the influence of it in your daily life, then it will give you that much more confidence in the value of meditation. So in daily life, we are dealing with hindrances and negative mental states on a regular basis. Things like greed and aversion and irritation and laziness and agitation and worry and confusion and so on. But because things are happening so quickly, and because we're involved in conversations and having to act, it's very difficult to distinguish each particular mental state and to learn about it and how to deal with it. So it's somewhat comparable to trying to follow the movement of an object against a very complex screen with many different colors and all kinds of different movement. Whereas in meditation, it's as if you replace the very complex screen with a white screen, and so it's that much more difficult, much more easy, to see the moving object, meaning your mind, and to see the arising of, for instance, boredom or laziness or agitation, and to see them as mental states that arise because there are causes and conditions for them to arise. They stay in the mind because there are causes and conditions for them to be there, and if they pass away, it's because there are causes and conditions. So we're studying causality, understanding the nature of mental phenomena as mental phenomena by isolating them, by cutting down on sense experience for certain periods of the day. It's a much more penetrative and direct looking at experience and learning from it. So this is the idea that we're seeking to develop, this sense of wakefulness, awareness, ability to about to protect the mind from unwholesome or negative mental states, to effectively deal with negative mental states that do arise, and to be creating positive mental states, and to be nurturing and bringing to maturity the positive mental states that have already arisen. And through applying ourselves to that process, what we call right effort, in a very wholehearted way in meditation, we create an ability and a fluency with which we can then carry on the very same process, but in different ways, in various situations we find ourselves in daily life.
We've talked about the role of teachers. In Buddhist education, how important are parents as role models for the students?
Well, as you know, the Buddha gave great importance to the parent-child relationship, and he compared the parent to the Brahma god, and to a deity even. He said parents are the ones who show the world to the children. They introduce the world to their children. Now introducing the world doesn't just mean in the world in the sense that we can learn about the world from textbooks or history and geography and so on and so forth, but it's the personal world, and in terms of the meaning of experience. So we always experience life in terms of different frames of reference, and our first frames of reference are given to us by our parents. Let us say the parents take the children out on into town, and the kind of things that parents are interested in, the things that excite them, the things that they praise or they blame, these are giving frames of reference to children. So if parents are very fascinated by material things and beautiful clothes and expensive cars and so on, then as they express that interest, they are promoting certain value system without intentionally teaching the children, but the child takes the parent as almost the god, the infallible authority, and so the values of parents have a very important conditioning role in the psychology of the child, but also in terms of how parents live their life, how they spend their time, how they divide the time between their work, their enjoyments, their how much time they spend with their family. These are sending messages to the children about how important they are, whether a child feels completely, unconditionally loved, or whether it feels that the love it receives from parents is dependent upon certain factors, like being good or being quiet or being good at school, for instance. Again, it's not so much that parents deliberately want to teach their children that their love is dependent upon these kind of things. They would probably be horrified to think that that was the message the children got, but that's in fact what tends to happen. How parents relate to each other, providing a template for children to make use of in their life. If the husband and the wife have a disagreement and they're angry with each other, how do they deal with that kind of everyday conflict? Is it in a skillful way, through effort to communicate, to understand each other, to forgive, or is one side shouting and screaming, the other side going very silent or walking out of the house and just trying to ignore problems that arise? So there are all kinds of unskillful and dysfunctional ways of dealing with problems, and if parents deal with problems in these kinds of ways, they are at the same time teaching that same kind of unskillful behavior to their children. So it's no surprise that when parents wish, hope that their children will behave in certain ways, but they in fact act in the complete, to the complete contrary, and they've been displaying and modeling that behavior since the child was born, it's unsurprising whether the children find either they find themselves conflicted, or they rebel, or they're confused. So from what I've read and studied, and from speaking with people, I'm very much in agreement with the idea that children need to have clear-cut boundaries which are consistent and which don't vary according to the mood of the parents. And this, so yeah, to what extent those boundaries are strict or loose is not so important as the fact that they're all agreed upon and that they don't change. This is what gives the child the sense of security it needs. It knows, you know, how far the child can go. But if the boundary is changing, some days it's okay, some days it's not, or perhaps you can persuade the parent to change their attitude by crying or some other kind of manipulative behavior, then the child eventually becomes very confused and never develops a very strong moral basis. So, in summary, the parents have huge effect, both in what they consciously teach. Of course, don't mean to overlook that as well. The values that they teach, and the lessons that they share with the children. But perhaps what we overlook is that who the parents are, how they live their lives, how they relate to each other, their values, their other things that they think are important and unimportant, the priorities that they have in their lives. All these things are transmitted to the children in one way or another. So it's not that an education system of whatever kind, even say boarding school, where the children are at school continually for many days at a time, if the policies and the practice of the school is too much in conflict or out of harmony with the way that the parents are teaching the children, the way the parents live with their children, then it probably won't be successful. That's not to say, so in other words, that parents can say, well, I've done my bit, or, you know, well, this is all I can do, you take over and you sort the child out for me, for us, that obviously not going to work.
I would like to ask a follow-up question. To what extent does the role of parents vary according to different age groups, like kindergarten, primary, secondary, university level? Does the role of parents
it's
vary?
It's difficult, isn't it? And of course, I mean, in what I've just been saying, already referring to a family in which both the father and mother live together. And of course, more and more families now are single-parent families or divorced families, and so there are stepmothers and stepfathers and stepbrothers and stepsisters. So the whole situation is rather more complex. If you have a father who is absent or in divorce, then maybe a stepfather playing more of a role if the father than the birth father. So it's rather complex. I would say that the earliest years of life, the first 5 years of life, are when the influence of parents is strongest, and the extent to which that will wax or wane it depends to a certain extent on the family, particular families. For instance, if you have a single mother with one child, then the mother-child relationship will tend to be very strong throughout life. Families where you have where the parents have one child, and where they have three or four or five, obviously going to be quite different. And even for each child in the family, depending on whether the eldest child or the second child or the third child or the last born child. So there's a great deal of variation. But I think that generally we can say as children reach adolescence, then their friends, their own peer group becomes more and more important, and to a certain extent replaces the influence of parents in certain respects. Again, we get to university, and then not apart from the individual variations in families, we've got cultural variations where families in Thailand, for instance, are very, very different, generally speaking, from families in England. Or families in cultures and countries where you have a social security system and pension where elderly people are financially independent of their children, or where the state takes responsibility for care of the aged, then that affects relationships and families quite a lot. For children, of course, it's not just mother and father, it's grandparents as well. Mm-hmm. And to the extent, whether or not grandparents are still alive, or whether they are living alone or living with the family, an extended family, there are just so many possible variations here.
Now, I would like to focus on the adolescence. What are the special characteristics of Buddhist education that are needed in order to attract and sustain the attention of adolescents?
Well, again, it's kind of a difficult question in that adolescents vary hugely, and I would say in our particular situation here at Banyapati or Tosi School, we could also say where, at what age the adolescent was introduced to Buddhist education system. If a child comes through Tosi School from nursery level and has been sort of grounded in those principles, then although I think almost every child goes through a very stormy period during adolescence, just their whole identity is changing from that of being a child to being a young adult, and feel very insecure and very unsure of themselves and self-conscious and worried about their appearance or so many different pressures. So, I think that we've been talking about Buddhist education as a form in which we're trying to apply the underlying principles of the Buddha Dhamma, Buddhist teaching, Buddhist developmental psychology, to the education of children or adolescents. And so I think it's more in terms of certain principles of relationship, rather than say, oh, we have this particular kind of lesson or this particular kind of activity, but the whole culture of good friendship, of good kalyana, mitata, and encouragement to be looking at one's heart and mind and developing skillful means to deal with emotions and thoughts and feelings, and to consider that as one part of education. The particular meditation techniques that we use, again, children will vary, young adults or adolescents will vary to the extent to which they take to these things. If they've got a lot of energy in their bodies, then some more kind of energetic meditations will be easier for them. And if there is just the effort to maintain at least some basic sitting meditation, so that as the child gets older, then hopefully we'll start to be interested in pursuing that particular avenue more. So we have, for instance, this Banyapati school, this summer holidays, we've got two of the boys who have not shown any great interest in meditation at school, but they've both volunteered to become novices for a month, and so their life is going, in this coming month, is going to include quite a lot of meditation. And so, because that's come from them, and they've made that kind of commitment, then we hope that that's going to carry on into their life after they leave the monastery, and to be to have some kind of influence on their friends as well. I think the if we look in at meditation techniques as being predominantly aimed at either developing wholesome mental qualities, or as developing wisdom and understanding, then the actual form of those methods we can adapt and vary according to circumstances. So I think that having a regular meditation practice, as even if sometimes it seems as kind of like almost an empty ritual, it's creating a certain standard and a certain culture which provides the foundation for something which is more real and more useful at different times in the lives of different children.
The next question: how does keeping the five precepts and training of right conduct contribute to promotion of wisdom development?
Well, there's a famous simile in Buddhist tradition where, say, just as when we wash our hands, the left hand washes the right hand washes the left hand, similarly, sila, virtuous conduct, cleanses wisdom, and wisdom cleanses conduct. Now, the reason why that is the case is that if we are breaking precepts, it means we are acting upon quite coarse, negative mental states. So the mental state of the intention to hurt and harm others, or to steal, or to commit sexual misconduct, or to lie, these are quite coarse mental states, and they have significant karmic consequences. And if we are trying to develop and to cultivate our our minds, but at the same time are also following and strengthening the power of negative mental states, then it's like one step forward and two steps back. So it's never going to be very successful. If we want to overcome the negative mental states, then we have to gather our energies. First, we're not further strengthening them through acting and speaking on their through their stimulation. At the same time, we're working to undermine what's already there through meditation, awareness, and various other techniques. Now, if we're not keeping five precepts, then it has consequences both internally and externally. Externally, you're going to create an atmosphere which is not very pleasant, atmosphere of suspicion and feeling of lack of safety and lack of warmth and friendliness. You can't trust people who don't keep the precepts. So the fundamental condition for a pleasant environment, social environment, is mutual trust, and the precepts provide that. So we're not taking a very unrealistic, idealistic, we're all Buddhists, we should all be kind and love each other. Well, that would be very nice, but it's not likely, given the way that our minds are in their untrained state. But what we can all agree upon is that even if we do feel or have very negative and unwholesome mental states, we will at least not act upon them. So if we live with people who all voluntarily agree upon that, then we do feel a sense of mutual respect and safety and security. Now, if you're living in a very unsafe, insecure environment, where you're suspicious of the intentions and actions of people around you, then your mind is always going to be on a very coarse level, and the ability to let go of thought and anxiety, ability to develop a more penetrating understanding of life, is going to be very difficult. Similarly, if you're acting in unwholesome ways, we tend to feel a sense of shame and embarrassment and guilt and a lack of self-esteem. And when that's the case, then the likelihood that you'll be willing to spend time and effort on cultivating your mind when you have very negative view of yourself, again, is unlikely. You know, you always feel, well, maybe meditation and Buddhist practice will make me calm and happy and so on, but I don't deserve that because I'm a bad person because I do all these bad things. So this feeling you don't really deserve to be peaceful and happy. That kind of thought can arise very often in someone who doesn't keep precepts. So if you've acted in unwholesome ways and you conceal it, then you're always going to have that fear of being found out. And again, this sense of tension and suppression or repression, these will make spiritual cultivation, the practice of Buddha's path, very, very difficult. So through keeping of precepts, care about how we act and speak, then we're free of remorse and guilt. The mind, which is free of remorse and guilt, unnecessary agitation, is one which is present, able to be present and able to reflect upon experience and learn from experience and develop wisdom. Similarly, the more that we reflect on what's appropriate, what's inappropriate, the consequences of actions, the law of karma, the more we use the wisdom faculty on its basic level of reflective thought, then the more value we see in keeping the precept. So again, there's this two-way process.
Finally, can Prajan comment briefly on the strong points and weaknesses of running, offering a Buddhist education in the form of a boarding school in comparison with a day school?
Well, the advantages, I would say, that you have that kind of continuity, and often in the in day school, there's always this sense there's not enough time, and the children and the students often having so many external interests that never feels that there's really getting to the heart of the matter, or being able to develop any effective kind of training, particularly when a lot of the curriculum is defined by the Ministry of Education, and so the specifically Buddhist elements and Buddhist input is perhaps it's not as much as you would like in order to get some kind of result. So in boarding school, where the advantage is that the children are developing that kind of relationship with the teachers and with the environment, and being able to apply their mind to this whole process without interruptions and without too many social obligations, family obligations. Disadvantages, of course, I mean, children miss their parents, and parents miss their children, or grandparents, and so their day-to-day contact with family is much reduced, and that may or may not be a good thing for children. But I would say that the distractions in the boarding school are much less, and the chances that children will get caught up in groups and trivial or even harmful activities is much less. For Panyapatip school, it's early days yet, and I think that the most effective and convincing answer to this will come when some children have been through this process themselves, and they can see what indeed they have received from it. I think that living in a beautiful part of the countryside, not too far from home, having a certain distance, and speaking someone who grew up in a place, having a certain distance from parents, but being able to see them every couple of weeks for a weekend, it's not such a long time, and there's long holidays, it's not like the children are going to the other side of the world, and it's not like in Sipendin where boy goes off to England if you don't see him for a few years. I mean, there's the communications and email and it's just down the road really from Bangkok. So I think in a particular situation here, it's it's kind of like middle way, really.